From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Fresno, California, on May 27th. Presidential candidate Donald Trump told the audience that, contrary to what scientists have said, there is no drought in California. He said the problem is that environmentalists were pushing esoteric causes and shipping the available water out to sea. He said he would fix that as president. The crowd cheered. On the question of a drought, he is very plainly wrong. There is indeed a serious drought in California. By some estimates, California growers had to fallow 540,000 acres last year. This year, more than 300,000 acres will not be farmed because of a lack of water. The agricultural industry has taken about a $1 billion hit. KQED reports that more than 70% of California has been in extreme drought, with nearly half the state in exceptional drought as of this past April, the most serious category according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. And for the first time, the drought now polls as the top concern of Californians. But what about water systems? Is Trump right about that? Do we need to change how we've adapted to water rights, for example? And by the way, is climate change contributing to drought? How does it impact us? We're going to cover it from a number of angles in our monthly science roundtable exploring these questions. Let me go ahead and welcome my guests now for the hour. Josh Goldowitz is here, professor and undergraduate coordinator for the Environmental Sustainability Health and Safety Degree Program in the College of Applied Science and Technology at RIT. It's a mouthful. Josh, welcome.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Thanks for being here. Matthew Hoffman's here as well. Matt's an assistant professor in the School of Mathematical Sciences at RIT. Matthew, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me on, Evan.
And on the phone with us is Craig Miller, senior editor of Climate Watch at KQED in California. Craig, welcome to you as well. All right, let's go ahead. And I'm sorry, we're going to get Craig in a second. Let me say hello to our other phone guest, John Stella. John's an associate professor in the Department of Forest and Natural Resource Management with SUNY ESF. John, welcome to you.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, let me start with the question of what Mr. Trump said. And we're not going to spend the whole hour on Donald Trump, but his comments did spark a conversation about the science of drought and the science of water. So let's go ahead and listen to what he said in Fresno on May 27th.
We're going to solve your water problem. You have a water problem that is so insane. It is so ridiculous, where they're taking the water and shoving it out to sea. And I just met with a lot of the farmers who are great people, and they're saying, we don't even understand it. They don't understand. Nobody understands it. And I've heard this from other friends of mine in California, where they have farms up here, and they don't get water. I said, oh, that's too bad. Is it a drought? No, we have plenty of water. I said, what's wrong? Well, we shove it out to sea. And I said, why? And nobody even knows why. And the environmentalists don't know why. Now, they're trying to protect a certain kind of 3-inch fish. But, No, think of it. So nobody even knows why. And by the way, the environmentalists don't know why. And, you know, I should say this. I've received many, many environmental rewards. Rewards and awards. I have done very well environmentally, and I'm all for it. But you have some people that really want to just get in the way. And I don't know if it's for their ego or what, but there are so many things. And, you know, we want jobs. We have to bring jobs back. And if we can bring this part of the world water that we have, but it's true. I've gotten so many of the awards, and I'm proud of them. And there are some great environmentalists and some great environmental people, and they really do. You know, my environmental standard is very simple, and I've said it to everybody. I want clean air, and I want clean water. That's what I want. Clean air, clean water. Very, very simple. So anyway, so we're going to be back up here. If I win, believe me, we're going to start opening up the water so that you can have your farmers survive, so that your job market will get better.
All right, so that's Donald Trump talking about
ROC50.
Wow, I'm hearing something in my ear. I just heard something. Oh, okay. Anyway, listen, it's been a bit of a rocky start, but I think we're going to be just fine here. Donald Trump on May 27th talking about his view of the drought and water problem in California. And I think we've got Craig Miller on the line now, the senior editor of Climate Watch at KQED. Craig, are you there? Do we have you there, Craig? We don't have Craig. Okay, so let's do this. Let's start in studio with for some reaction from our guests. Matthew Hoffman is an assistant professor in the School of Mathematical Sciences at RIT, and Josh Goldowitz, also at RIT. Josh, I'll start with you, because all of our guests sort of come at this from different angles when it comes to looking at the science of drought and climate, et cetera. What stood out to you from those remarks?
I guess what stood out for me is, a great writer once said, every complex problem has a simple solution, and it's always wrong. Drought is a relatively difficult topic. It's not just did it rain recently. We're going to look at the rainfall. We're going to look at how much water is in reservoirs. We're going to look at how much snow is in the snowpack that'll melt during the summer to feed the reservoirs. Look at how much water is in the soil ready for the plants to take it up. So it's a relatively complex topic. It's not really a soundbite kind of an issue, I feel.
But there is a drought.
Absolutely, there's a drought.
There's a drought.
I mean, the Golden State Warriors are not in a drought, but the rest of California.
You're talking to a Clevelander. Let's just leave that alone. But yes, there is a drought outside of Golden State. That's fine. Let's turn now to Matt Hoffman. What stands out to you from those remarks there?
Well, again, as both of you have been saying, there's clearly a drought, right? A 2014 Geophysical Research Letters article pegged it from tree ring data as maybe the worst in 1,200 years out there, just in terms of the amount of water that's going on. And as was just said, there's a lot that goes into it. It's not just the rain. And when we talk about climate effects, temperature and things like that have a lot to do with it. So what stands out is that it's sort of a very simplification of particular environmental regulations that are leading to the distribution of water, what's going to farmers and what's going for maintenance of the Delta region and the habitat of several species of fish that are endangered and are on federal protection lists. And that's sort of what is leading a lot of the water to be diverted out to the bay.
On that subject, Matt, you mentioned diverting water. Trump was saying nobody knows why some water. First of all, he's implying that any available water is just being pushed into the ocean. It's not any available water. The Fresno Bee reports that some fresh water does flow out to the ocean through the Delta, and it's for a good reason. It's not an unknown reason at all. This is according to the public affairs officer for the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. Fresh water is necessary to control the level of salt coming in from the Pacific Ocean. The area is considered an estuary where fish river water mixes with salty ocean water. So, Matt, it's not a mystery as to what's going on, and it's also not all available water that environmentalists are just dumping in the ocean so farmers can't have it.
As you said, the reasons are well known, and interestingly, it actually serves two purposes. Not only does it help with the fisheries, right, the salmon and the Delta smelt that is what Trump is referencing, but also some of that water and the salinity controls are used for both urban and agricultural use. So some of that water actually goes back to agriculture. Just to try to improve the water. And so it's about 20% of that water. But agriculture takes about 80% of the water that's sort of available in the first place.
So it's not all that mysterious anyway.
It's very, very unmysterious.
Josh, you want to weigh in there? Go ahead, Josh.
Well, I just want to agree with Matt on that. And it's also important to note that fresh water is being allowed into the bay. Which is kind of what rivers do. That's the natural system that you'd expect to have happen. And the bays and estuaries perform some really important ecological services for us. So, for instance, towns and cities might treat their wastewater, but then the treated wastewater is let into the bay. The bay and estuary and wetlands in the area provide for hundreds of species. So, to try to make it appear that this water is being put into the bay for the benefit of one single fish is an extreme oversimplification.
All right, let me try the phones again. I've got Craig Miller, the senior editor of Climate Watch at KQED, on the line with us. Hello, Craig.
Good morning, or afternoon in your case.
Yeah, and you're no stranger to Rochester, I'm told.
No, absolutely not. I went to an RIT graduate, and I lived there for a few years, worked for Channel 13.
Very good. Well, it's nice to have you, Craig. And I know you have done a lot of work for KQED on Climate Watch, on the issue of drought. You guys are among many journalists out there that have put together, I think, really helpful interactive maps at times and helping your listeners understand what's going on. What was the reaction in general when Mr. Trump was made those remarks that there is no drought in California?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. You know, the, making the statement that the drought in California is man-made, when a politician says that, you know, he's pandering basically to some farming interests who think, as your guests have just described, that more water should be diverted, you know, from Northern California's rivers in particular, you know, down through the Central Valley, you know, for irrigation, which sets up this whole sort of farms versus fish dichotomy that you described, which is really an oversimplification of the water, of the hydrology of California. But when he says there's no drought, he's just wrong. The California is truly in uncharted territory right now. Even though last winter wasn't too bad, we had an El Nino condition in the Pacific, which delivered near average precipitation and rain and snow. It's still not where it should be. And now it looks like the whole thing is flipping into a La Nina phase, which for California could mean another winter of drought ahead. We depend on really get half of our precipitation during just about a three-month window during the winter time. So we have a really narrow window to get what we need. And for several years running now, we just haven't been getting it. So there's definitely still a drought in California.
And let me also bring in John Stella, associate professor in the Department of Forest and Natural Resource Management at SUNY ESF, who has plenty of experience in California himself. And John, what stood out to you from the opening comments you heard from the candidate?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, Trump's claim that all he cared about was clean air and clean water, and the rest should go to the farmers. But in fact, the fresh water that comes through the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, it's very important for pushing back the level of salinity in the bay, not only for the ecosystem, but many of the communities around San Francisco Bay actually have water intakes in the Delta area. So if more water was diverted south to the Central Valley into the Los Angeles region, those areas would be drinking salt water. Another issue that came out is when he said that the drought was man-made, there is an element of truth to that, but it's not at all what he's intending. Drought is, besides climatic drought, which the other speakers discussed, drought is simply when demand outstrips supply. And as Craig said, you know, California has a very narrow window of opportunity where all the rain comes in the winter. There's an annual drought because there's no water, there's no rain that falls during the growing season. So all of it needs to be stored. In addition to this, we do have periodic droughts. We are in the worst one currently, but there have been other ones in the mid-70s, in the 1930s. That's a normal part of California's climate. What isn't normal is the intense population demand on the system and the infrastructure that is now aging and not able to deliver water. The other thing that underlies all of this is a fundamentally broken system of water rights in California, in which a very few senior water rights holders claim and have legal claim to most of the water. So people complain about the environment receiving too much water, but in essence, there's a very poor distribution system in California. Water rights have been redistributed or have been reformed throughout the West, but California is one of the holdouts in which it's using a late 1800s system of water rights to try to solve a 21st century problem of distribution.
Craig Miller, is there any movement for that to change?
Well, when you talk about messing with water rights in California, that really is the third rail of California politics. If you look at this, how long it took, how many years, how many decades it took just to get a law passed to begin to monitor and start to regulate groundwater extraction from California, I'll give you an idea. If you look at a place like Australia, what they went through with their 10-year drought, it really forced them to change a lot of things. And their water rights system over there is much more even-handed. When there's, as is described to me, when water is in short supply, everybody gets a haircut. where here in California, as your guest just described, there's a pecking order. And basically the people at the top of the pecking order get, in many cases, as much as they want, almost regardless of circumstances, and people at the bottom of the order can end up with none. So it does seem like a system whose time is ripe for change, but it's going to be very difficult.
Josh, you want to weigh in? Go ahead.
Yes, I did. Thank you, Evan. Water rights are quite a fascinating topic and not a new topic at all. Mark Twain said, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting over. So this is not a new area. But there really, just for the view, for the listener's benefit, there are two types of water rights. One is riparian, and riparian means if you own land adjacent to a body of water, you have the right to extract a certain amount of water from that body of water, and it's based on how much frontage you have. In a lot of Western states, including most parts of California, they use prior appropriation as a way to determine who has the water right. And prior appropriation means if you've been using the water for a long period of time, the amount of water you get to use is based on how much you use and how long you've been using it for. So that's been called cowboy water law. And it doesn't necessarily mean, as a matter of fact, it doesn't at all mean that the most efficient use of water is really going to rise to the top, because those who have the longest right or have had the longest prior appropriation get to use, as Craig said, almost as much water as they want, as long as they can show that they've been using it for a long time.
All right, so these things are not mutually exclusive. You can have a serious drought, which California does, and you can have a system of water rights management that isn't necessarily as adaptive as other states have, and that maybe is ripe for some change. Those things are not mutually exclusive. And here's the American thinker online defending Trump, saying that because we've got this antiquated system, really the problem is government. So let me go ahead and read this. This is from the American Thinker Online. Quote, historically, California has a mega wet year once about every 10 years, with many wet years in between. So 4 out of 5 years, or as much as 8 out of every 10 years, are dry years where reservoirs aren't filling up enough and groundwater basins aren't being recharged enough, except by the runoff from farmers' fields and by recycling in urban areas. So Trump is right that there is no California drought, although there has been a hot spell and a man-made water shortage only from the failure of government to plan for normal drought. Craig, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I take the point that there certainly are aspects of this in which we've made our own bet. There's no question about that. But one of the things I'd like to point out is that when we talk about what has happened in California historically, I'm not so sure how much value that is either, because things are changing so rapidly out here. We're not really sure what the new normal is. And while it's true that California has wild swings back and forth between wet years and dry years, the outlook for the future is, I think, definitely generally drier. And also, in terms of when we need the water, it's a very, you know, it's a deteriorating situation.
Well, and on that note, let me read from Phil Plait, who is a science writer for Slate Magazine Online, who writes that no matter what you think of what's going on in California, he doesn't trust the candidate, Mr. Trump, because Mr. Trump's main energy advisor is a climate denier, and Trump himself is a climate denier. So here's Phil Plait writing his Slate. Quote, you know what else this situation needs? At the very least, an acknowledgement that climate change is real. Environmental scientist Peter Gleck and climatologist Michael Mann wrote a commentary in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences saying there is accumulating evidence that anthropogenic climate changes are already influencing the frequency, magnitude, and the duration of drought in California. Let me ask the entire panel about this, and I will start with Craig Miller, senior editor of Climate Watch at KQED. You know, I think, Craig, to some degree, when it comes to weather events, day-to-day, week-to-week, there is sometimes a jump to be, if there's a tornado in New York State, Governor Cuomo is going to blame climate change. We know that. And sometimes we may overdo the day-to-day without looking at the macro. But in general, is there a feeling among scientists in California that the severity of the drought is at least related in some way to climate?
Oh, yes. And I think that you said the key word there when you mentioned severity. Don't forget, temperature affects drought. We've been getting record heat in California over the last few years. And when it's hotter, It increases evaporation. It sucks moisture up through plants and into the atmosphere and out of the ground, and makes all the drought conditions that much worse. And so it's a combination of things that are happening. Columbia, an interesting study out of Columbia University last year, actually tried to make a connection, tried to quantify exactly how much worse the California's drought was because of the temperature anomalies, that is, how much hotter than normal it was. And so we're really starting to see, I think, pretty clearly that these are effects from long-term climate change coupled with what's going on in the Pacific Ocean. When I talk about El Nino and La Nina, that's what I mean.
Okay. Matthew Hoffman?
Yeah, so I just wanted to follow up on what Craig said, citing the PNAS article that Michael Mann wrote. That actually quotes another article by Diffenbaugh et al. And what they're talking about is actually what they find in their data and what several other people have found is that if you look at the trends in precipitation, they haven't changed dramatically in California. So basically, if you look at the number of abnormally dry years in terms of precipitation, they haven't changed a ton from, say, 1896 to now over the last 20 years. But what has changed is temperature. And so if you look at the wet years or the dry years that are cold versus dry years that are warm, right, you're twice as likely to have a severe drought if with the added temperature. And so with the climate predictions, it's that temperature effect that you're really seeing.
Okay, so in other words, go ahead, Craig.
This is John.
Oh, John, go ahead.
Yeah, if I can add, the importance of temperature, besides increasing evaporation and creating, you know, dryness for agriculture during the summer, the real importance is that it's reducing the amount of snowpack in the Sierra Nevada mountains, which stretch all through California's spine. And that reduces the amount of water that nature has in its own reservoirs, which is the snowpack. And it quickens the rate at which it melts. So what that means is it's the equivalent of very large reservoirs that are no longer available to store water for the growing season. So the farmers in the valley are directly dependent on this. And because of increased warming, the snowpack is reducing quite dramatically and has been since the 1980s.
Okay, Craig, I know you're short on time, so as we get ready to let you go, we'll continue our discussion. And listeners, in our second half hour, we're going to take your calls and questions and kind of dive more into the subject of the science behind what's going on, not only in the American West, but how it could impact all of us. I mean, you know, California is an important state in our country, and we already have questions about agriculture, impact of water usage there. But Craig, some final thoughts from you for our listeners as we look at what's happening in your state.
Well, I'm glad the snowpack question came up because that's something I think is people in other parts of the country have trouble getting their heads around very often. They call the Sierra snowpack, you know, our frozen reservoir, and the state actually in typical years counts on that for about one-third of its water supply. This year we had a near-average snowpack. The year before, however, there was no snow when it was supposed to be peaking in the Sierra, virtually no snow. And by using tree rings and other means of tracing it back, they've determined that it was probably the lowest snowpack in 500 years. So, again, it's snowpack and timing. The snowpack's important because it's not just, because of this problem of when we get our rain and snow, we got to somehow keep it for the growing season in the summer. And the snowpack is a natural and vital way to do that. The only other way to do it is to build more reservoirs. And that is also something that's extremely controversial.
Craig, we found a lot of great work at KQED online. Where do you like to send people to learn more about the drought and climate in California?
Oh, thanks for asking. KQED.org/science.
Great stuff. And thanks for taking the time to come back to your old digs and to join the conversation today, Craig.
Thanks for having me.
Craig Miller is the senior editor of Climate Watch at KQED. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back with our guest talking in our monthly science roundtable about the science of drought in the American West. Matthew Hoffman, assistant professor in the School of Mathematical Sciences at RIT. Josh Goldowitz is a professor and undergraduate coordinator for the Environmental Sustainability Health and Safety Degree Program at RIT, and John Stella on the line. He's an associate professor in the Department of Forest and Natural Resource Management for SUNY ESF. Take your phone calls as well in our second half hour after this short break. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on Connections, we talk to civil rights activist Sylvia Mendez, who at the age of 8 played a major role in desegregating schools in California. She's coming to Rochester for the opening of a new play based on her life. We'll talk to her about her activism, and we'll take a look at the state of equality in Rochester schools. That's all coming up Tuesday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. If you've got questions or comments that you'd like to make about the science of drought in the American West and how it impacts all of us, you can call the program toll-free now, 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255. And I think Bill in Brighton can help us kick off the second half hour with our guests here in our Science Roundtable, because he's talking about crops and livestock in California, which is, of course, at the heart of all of this. Go ahead, Bill. Are you there, Bill? Hold on, Bill. Boy, oh boy. Let's try now. Go ahead, Bill. We don't have Bill. Boy, oh boy, there's something going on the phones today. Bill, I put you back on hold. You stay there. And in just a second, we're going to kick your way here.
Sounded like a good question, too.
I'm sure it is a great question. So, Bill, stay there. And let me go to John Stella, because before the program began, I had a chance to talk to John about a related issue that a lot of people have, which is on agriculture, which takes up, from what I'm reading, John, most of the water in California. Is that right?
That's right. Agriculture is responsible for about 80% of water consumption in California. The other 20% goes to cities and industrial use.
Okay. And, you know, so a lot of people have looked at things like almonds, avocados, rice, et cetera, things grown in places that are requiring what appears to us from the outside as enormous amounts of water. First of all, sort of crudely, John, do we need to take a fresh look at why we are growing certain things in certain places? And do we need to start making some long-term planning changes for what we're growing and where?
Well, the short answer is yes. But the longer answer is that it refers to what Craig was talking about earlier, which is that changing water use is really a third rail in California, because there is no statewide planning as to who can grow which crops. I mean, I think that people would think that's fundamentally un-American, right? For a farmer to be told what he or she can plant. But what is planted is very much determined by how much water the farmers have. So those with senior water rights will grow rice or almonds, and those who don't have much water will grow less water-hungry crops. The difficulty with crop use is that the issue is timing and infrastructure. Rice used to be the bad boy of California agriculture. Everybody hated the fact that rice was grown in the Central Valley, because much of it was evaporated while the fields were wet. Nowadays, there's partnerships with the Nature Conservancy and other conservation groups to actually use those wet fields as important feeding habitat for birds on the Pacific Flyway, and so there's these partnerships to make this byproduct of what used to be a wasteful agriculture better for the environment. On the other hand, almonds have been are sort of the new bad boy, and much of the reason is that the price of almonds has skyrocketed. And many farmers have now planted almonds and other nut crops in more marginally productive places. They use a lot of water, and even when drip irrigation is used, what happens is that you basically have a built-in fixed demand where, you know, some crops like alfalfa or other low-quality crops don't necessarily need to be watered every year. You know, basically the field can be fallowed. But with nut crops and the investment and you can't not water the almond trees, because they'll die, and you've just lost a 10-year investment.
So, John, let me just jump in, and this is a question I'm sure some people have, and I'm not even sure it's fair to ask, but does that mean we shouldn't be eating California almonds? Do you buy fewer California almonds because of that?
I sure do. I've stopped buying almonds, and I love them. But when I found out more about it, I thought, oh, this is not something that I really want to support.
I know Josh Goldowitz wanted to weigh in on this as well. Go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, the question of agricultural crops in California, I mean, this is a worldwide issue. You know, problem in California, one of the major problems in California is that the water is in the north and the east, and most of the population lives in the south. But if you think of any large river that flows through a desert area, so you can think of the Nile in Egypt, or you can think of the Tigris and Euphrates going through Iraq and Turkey, or you can think of the rivers in India and Pakistan, the water starts in the mountain someplace as snowmelt. The water doesn't come from the desert, and then it flows through desert area. Flat desert areas might be excellent farming areas if you can divert all that water from the rivers into agriculture. But we, meaning just all of us as human beings, make some really seriously silly decisions in terms of water use. So in many areas of the world, including California, where water is relatively scarce, water might be used for very low-quality, low-price crops or crops that are very, very water-intensive and shouldn't be used in the desert. And I think rather than talking about telling farmers what crops they should or should not grow, what another approach would be to make the price of water that the farmers pay more reasonable and reflective of the actual price. So, for instance, there are some farmers in California who are paying $18 for an acre foot of water. An acre foot of water is the unit we use in agriculture. It means an acre of land covered by 1 foot of water. If you or I were to buy that, it's around 325,000 gallons. If you or I were to buy that same amount of water from the Monroe County Water Authority the way we do in our homes, using the amount we pay for water, we'd pay around $1,100 for an acre foot.
$1,100 and they pay $18?
They pay $18. So if they were paying something a little closer to the real value of that water, I mean, it's hugely subsidized by the federal government.
But what would that do to food prices?
So the first thing that would happen is, well, you certainly wouldn't change the price overnight from $18 to $1,000 for an acre foot, but you might raise the price to some level so that the farmers would have a good incentive to possibly switch towards more efficient irrigation methods, or possibly switch out of some of the very, very high water use, low value crops.
That was a Freudian slip there. The crops that they're growing and where. But to John's point there, yeah, then all of a sudden you're thinking a lot harder about, is this a good place for almonds? Is this a good place for whatever the crop is?
Absolutely. Yeah. No one should grow cotton in a desert. It makes no sense. But if you look at for instance, the Indus River flowing through Pakistan, one-third of all the water flowing down the Indus River is used to grow cotton.
So that makes sense, is what you're saying.
Well, no, they're in the same situation.
Oh, you're saying it doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make sense.
I see what you're saying.
Oh, so I'm sorry. Yeah, so they're in the same situation where
bad decisions cotton, on what you're growing.
Cotton uses a lot of water, and but it grows fantastically well in a desert with warm climate, lots of sun, as long as you provide it with water.
Yeah, okay. And Matthew, you want to weigh in before I get back to the phones?
Go ahead. Only one thing I wanted to say is that, back to Trump's comment, the sort of the distinction in terms of the fish versus farm discussion we were having is, we were talking about this 80% agricultural, 20% urban, and that's sort of the available water, right? About 50% of the water goes to environmental uses, and that includes things like Delta Recharge, also just streams that are completely undammed or anything like that. So there's sort of this 50% that I think agricultural interests would say, oh, we would want more of that, right? They're not taking it from the urban. They would want to take it from the environmental piece.
Okay, I've got Bill in Brighton back on the line. Go ahead, Bill. Oh, I made the mistake this time. Now let's try it. Bill, I think I can hear you now. How's this? Bill? We're going to do this the whole hour, aren't we? Oh, boy.
We can just keep talking.
Boy, I know you guys are doing great, but I know our callers want to weigh in. Let me try line two. Bill, stay there. We'll see if we can get Paul in Irondequoit. Paul, are you there?
Yeah, I frequent California quite a bit, and I find it really interesting, the water thing. It's highly complicated. But here's two things I'd like to say.
Sure.
All the sewers that I see throughout California are stamped drained to ocean. Here we recycle the water through the Pure Waters. I don't know if they have Pure Waters there. I think they should get it. The other thing I would like to say is, what led me down a road years ago, previous to air conditioning, looking around on the internet to see what they did, they had cold storage. cold storage transported ice to dry areas of the country from the Northeast. And it was highly profitable. And the quality of the water and everything else was judged. I don't know if it'd be practical in today's world to do that, but I think that it would. And that's my comments, and I'll let you guys go. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul, for the phone call. Let me start with John Stella. You heard what he had to say. What do you think, John?
Well, the sewers that are stamped drains to the ocean, was it an environmental movement to try to make people aware of not to pour things like motor oil and stuff in the gutters because they go to the storm drains? I don't know of any way to purify that, because those drain directly into water bodies. And I'm not familiar with the cold storage issue. I know that there've been some crazy schemes to bring things like water in giant rubber bags down from Alaska to California for offshore. And now certain communities are seriously considering desalinization. But that's quite expensive, and it's a ways off for most coastal communities in California.
Okay, Professor Goldowitz.
The caller had an interesting point about the water going into the sewers that are stamped goes directly to ocean. There are some parts of the world where all that water is captured and used not so much for agriculture, but just to increase the humidity of the region. So there are some countries in the Middle East that are capturing all the runoff off of highways and channeling it into small areas where they can grow like a little oasis, and that can be effective. So there's a lot that we could do to improve our infrastructure in order to lower the water use or do more reuse of water, or as John mentioned, more desalinization, which is already done in plenty of places in the U.S.
All right, let's see here. Third time's a charm. I know this is going to work. Our friend Bill in Brighton has been so patient. Are you there, Bill?
Yes.
Thank you, Bill. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'll move on from where you were with almonds.
Okay.
There was an op-ed piece in the New York Times a couple weeks ago about the tragedy of subsidiary dams of the Colorado River or its tributaries. Number one, there is so little water behind these dams, they can't officially produce electricity for areas that never should have had crops in the first place, but they had them because of the miracle of these dams. And number two, the evaporation rates are enormous. And the environmentalist was pleading for the destruction of at least five or six dams in the Colorado tributary. And I thought it was quite interesting, because one of your panelists talked about people growing things in areas they really shouldn't have been growing in the first place.
Bill, thank you very much for the phone call, and thanks for hanging in there. I suspect all three of our guests are going to want to get in on that. I'm going to start in studio. I'll start with Matthew Hoffman. Go ahead, Matthew.
Just quickly, Josh might know more about the Colorado River, but I know we were talking about snowpack in the Sierra Nevada, and one of the consequences of the depletion in California, talking about dams and electricity, as I think in 2014, there was about a 50% decrease in the amount of electrical production from hydroelectric plants in California as a consequence of the drought. So this is one of those additional impacts in addition to agriculture and environment.
Professor Goldowitz.
Yeah, well, thank you. The caller is absolutely right. The Colorado River has got quite an amazing situation. The amount of water from the Colorado River that is promised to the states that border it, so Nevada, California, Colorado, Arizona, and then Mexico, the amount of water that is promised to those states each year is more than the flow of the Colorado River in most years. So once the river reaches the border with Mexico and would be flowing into Mexico, there would be no water flowing into Mexico at all, except that we have huge desalinization plants desalinating the wastewater coming back from the irrigated fields so that there can be some good quality water delivered to Mexico. But it's interesting, the caller noted that environmentalists are talking about getting rid of some of these dams, but it's interesting that not only environmentalists, but there are quite a few managers at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which regulate some of these dams, that also think some of the dams should be taken down.
Professor Stella, what do you think?
Well, there's the other panelists are correct in that the Colorado is grossly oversubscribed, and again, historically, the lower basin, which is the states of California, Arizona, have developed their water infrastructure long before the upper basin states, which is Utah, Wyoming, and Colorado. And now the upper basin states are wanting their share, but because of the distribution of water, they don't have enough, nor does Mexico. Now, there's a number of reasons to take dams down, and it's true that the Army Corps of Engineers and other dam building agencies are now thinking of decommissioning or taking down dams, and a number of those reasons are that that they're hydroelectrically they're not efficient anymore, they may be filling with sediment, or in the case of the Colorado and some of the large dams, the climate projections are that they'll never fill again. Lake Powell on the Colorado is very far below capacity, and it's thought that it won't fill capacity based on our current climate, which is the climate change is changing even faster in the Southwest than it is in California.
John, let me ask all three of you sort of a question on where we go forward. We got an email from a listener named Rebecca who said climate change is real. It's not going to get better, more than likely. And why are we having so many people live and require agriculture from a place that is clearly stressed? So let me broaden Rebecca's email question with this. I read the piece in the New Yorker last fall about the possibility of a catastrophic earthquake, not in California, but in the Pacific Northwest. That was a bit of a horrifying article, but a very interesting read. And some of the experts mentioned in that article indicate that if we were to repopulate right now, we maybe would be shifting Portland and Seattle's home base. Maybe not, but maybe. I mean, you have to consider all of these things and where you're putting population centers. Then there's a question of California. If climate change is not going to, quote unquote, get better, and one of the functions is higher temperatures, more drought, then do we need to slowly start thinking about, not only we've been talking about food production, but thinking about population centers? I mean, that's a huge question. But John, Stella, is the horse out of the barn there? I mean, or am I being too pessimistic in asking the question? What do we do?
Well, it's going to be very difficult to control population growth, except that, you know, currently the expense of living in certain parts of California is certainly controlling the amount of people coming in. But I don't think that water is going to be limiting cities and the growth of cities. But in agriculture, I think it will play more and more of a role. The sort of best thinkers of about how to fix water, California's water problem, there's a number of folks throughout the state, including Dr. Jay Lund at UC Davis and Peter Moyle at UC Davis. They advocate a portfolio of different solutions, but they have to be done in concert. And there's no silver bullet, there's no magic solution to California's water problems. But it's going to have to involve loosening some regulations in terms of water transfers. It will also have to be improving technologies such as desalinization, and water pricing will also be really important. Water conservation will continue to be important. But the cities in California are some of the most water efficient in the country, and there's just not going to be a lot more that they can do in terms of solving the massive overages that the state is demanding currently.
Josh Goldowitz?
Well, I guess I disagree with that a little bit. I think water's the new oil. This is what wars are going to be fought over in the future. The U.S. State Department has identified 10 places on Earth where they think it's possible that there will be actual warfare over water rights. A desert, the definition for a desert is an area that gets so little rainfall that it can't support a significant human population. And yet Phoenix, is probably the fastest growing city in the country, and LA isn't far behind. So I think, you know, water pricing, real pricing, might induce people not to move to those areas. I mean, we in Rochester are blessed with a vast amount of water. You know, maybe people will start moving back to what's called the Rust Belt, because we will have the resource that is needed for industry, agriculture, and for people to live.
Yeah. Okay, Matthew?
And it's just quickly, I think it was funny because I was, about 8 years ago, I was in Brazil, and I remember getting yelled at by somebody down there because they were talking about the Iraq War and how they were sort of just getting mad at me in the future for the anticipating a war on Brazil for the Amazon River water. That was sort of getting prematurely yelled at for that. But in addition to add on to what Josh said, in addition to already the amount of water that we have here, right, climate projections for this region of the country are actually wetter and warmer. And so some of the future into this century projections are that we might actually have an extra month of growing season in the Rochester region.
And to Josh's point, listeners who saw the film The Big Short may remember that one of the people profiled, the person played by Christian Bale in that film, is someone who identified the financial collapse before it came. He is now investing in only one thing, and that is water. So interesting there. A few other points to get to before we close the hour. Jane in Rochester wants to talk about livestock. Go ahead, Jane.
Oh, I've been distracted now to just what you've been talking about, but I was referring back to your screener there about your Cowspiracy film that you talked about.
Sure.
And we were informed that California sells 100 billion gallons a year. And I also was privy to the information that Arizona sells their water also, and you were just your guest was just mentioning the great population and possible shortages. I see insanity in all of that. Would you comment, please?
Thanks very much, Jane. Thoughts to our guests here?
Oh, I think Jane is exactly right. You know, we people don't live where the water is, and water isn't where the people are. So we have a limited amount of water. You know, we had a green revolution in the 70s, increasing vastly the amount of crops that we produce. We can't really increase the amount of water we have. So it's a very, very serious issue, and it's a worldwide issue.
There is an article. Go ahead, John Stella. Go ahead.
Well, and one of the difficulties about water is that if you took the amount of fresh water on Earth and you averaged it for the world's population, there'd be plenty for people. But it's very difficult to get it from where it is to where it isn't, and it's even more difficult than say something like oil. So it will involve creating incentives for people to live where there's more abundant water. But I think that's going to be a long time in the making, and I think it's going to be coming less through revolutions, at least in this country, and more through things like water pricing and, you know, economic incentives that take into account the true cost of water.
To Jane's point about the film Cowspiracy, that comment called to mind for me an article that I'm going to mention in a moment. And this, what I'm about to mention, is just mentioned in the article. It is not the focus of the article. But the article mentioned the fact that if all of America went vegan for one day a week, not every day, not your whole life, but for one day a week, we would save the equivalent of the water, all of the water in the Colorado River on an annual basis. That's a lot of water. And the consumption of meat is certainly a way that uses a lot of water. Water goes to a lot of livestock. We know that. But the article that comes from is also worth a read, and it is long. A friend sent it to me one day this winter, and I printed it in the newsroom computer, and thank goodness my news director wasn't around because I didn't realize I was going to fell a tree doing it. I mean, it's a lot of pages, but I would recommend that you read it on some morning, pour a big mug of coffee, get up early. The article is called A Free Market Plan to Save the American West from Drought, and it's in the March issue of The Atlantic, and it talks about a man named Disc Dean Jr., who is looking at water sort of from this commodity perspective, making money, but also maybe putting in more effective systems. And John, you know, we don't have time to spend the rest of the hour on it. This is a fascinating question on its own, because Disc Dean Jr. views this as a free market way of sort of not only making money, but also helping more people. Whereas the article concludes with a different kind of proposal that's kind of a hybrid, that's a little bit more government control, but more aimed at adapting in sort of updating the California water system. What do you make of that? What's the short answer that you would give on what an adapted water system would look like in the West, especially California?
Well, I'd say that the benefits of free market are that you can put water to the most efficient use. But what that requires is true pricing, and it also requires water rights that don't gum up the system. If you have a few landowners or a few water rights holders that have all the water, they're not going to free it up to be available within a free market system. So it's going to have to go hand in hand with reform in terms of water law and in terms of water rights.
All right. And Josh, some final thoughts from you for our listeners. What do you want to leave our listeners with on this subject?
Well, one final thought is that it seems to me that Trump supporters supporting Donald Trump because he says that we should give more water to the farmers is a little bit strange because it's hugely subsidized. You would think that people who are interested in hugely subsidized water for farmers might be Bernie Sanders supporters since it's more a socialist issue. I think final wrap-up for me is that water is the new oil, and this is what we're going to be talking about going forward.
Well, it's our monthly science roundtable, and we've learned a lot. And unfortunately, this is a subject that I suspect is going to continue to be a problem as we learn this hour, not just for California, but for all of us, whether it comes to food prices, population, options for where you want to move and live. There's so many different things tied to it. And I want to thank our panel, Josh Goldowitz. Great to have you, Professor. Thanks for being here. Professor Matthew Hoffman as well from RIT. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. This is a lot of fun.
John Stella on the phone with us from the Department of Forest and Natural Resource Management at SUNY ESF. John, thank you as well.
Thank you very much.
And our thanks to Craig Miller from Climate Watch at KQED, also joining us earlier this hour. Packed hour. Thanks for all the phone calls and interaction in our monthly Science Roundtable. Our thanks to Kat Schwarz, engineer, Deprina Godboldo, who is our intern, and Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a wonderful afternoon.